This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome. Thanks for coming. This is the first evening of our LGBT health and transgender surgery mini med school. So if you're in the wrong place, I think you've probably figured that out by now. We're going to have a terrific 6 weeks, and you can see our sessions listed up there. And I'm just going to give a little bit of a intro to today and sort of talk a little bit about the timeliness of this mini med school. And then I'm going to introduce our speakers. My name is Elizabeth Wilson. I'm one of the co-course directors, and I'm sort of running the first three sessions, and then my colleague Maurice Garcia is going to run the last three sessions. So this is a little sneak preview of the first three sessions. So today we're going to hear about LGBTQ disparities and also learn about some of the work being done by the Family Acceptance Project. Next week we're going to be talking about violence and discrimination in the LGBT community. And on the third week, I'm actually not going to be here. Someone's going to be moderating a panel, and it's for LGBT trainees talking about their experiences. And so we'll have medical students, residents, and fellows on that panel. This is, so yesterday was National Coming Out Day. You know, this is an Australian superstar, I believe, who did a video. And... you know, every year feels like National Coming Out Day gets more and more press. And he was at the Billie Jean King Championship and did this video. And so just this week alone, yesterday, there's been a lot of press talking about LGBT people, LGBT issues, people coming out. And it sort of circles back around to thinking about LGBT disparities for us. So this is one of our former Dr. Eliseo Perez Stable was from UCSF, and he took a terrific job running the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities. And they have been looking at disparities mostly in race and ethnicity, also looking at disparities in sex, disparities in age, and just last week announced that they were going to be focusing on disparities in sex and gender minorities. And so this is, you know, a couple years ago, they said they would start sort of funding some of these projects, the NIH, and now that they're really doing a focus on this. One of the big things that those of us who work with LGBT populations or LGBT ourselves know that there are disparities. We lack some data, so it's actually hard sometimes to document the disparities, but there is data out there, and we need to collect more, which means we actually need to improve some of the tools we use to collect data, because they actually don't ask about sexual orientation and gender identity. So this is really, really good news at a national level that LGBT people are being included and really trying to document disparities, because in order to get resources and in order to make change, we need to document things. At UCSF, we're having a lot of conversations around disparities and diversity, and we're having a series of eye-opening conversations which are really directed at some of the leaders at UCSF, department chairs and the deans, and talking to them about disparities that exist and issues around diversity and inclusion. And so we had a recent focus on LGBT issues facing faculty, staff, and students. And it was very well attended. There were probably over 50 or 60 chairs and leaders at UCSF really engaged in the conversation. And finally, this is Diversity Month, and I wanted to bring your attention to something that hasn't happened yet. It's happening next week, and it's called the Coming Out Monologues, sponsored by the School of Nursing. So that's the building that we're in now. And this is there's a lot happening. at UCSF around diversity. Many of the events are open to the public, and we actually need to do better opening our events to the public and really encouraging people to come. So please spread the word. And if you look, we have something called the UCSF Office of Diversity and Outreach. I'm like, thank you. Like, trying to figure out the acronym. And they have a great calendar of events. UCSF Today also publishes a calendar of events. So keep your eyes peeled for those kinds of things. So that's actually all I have to say. I just want to kind of set the stage about what we're going to talk about. And I'm going to introduce the speakers for tonight. And I'm going to ask them to tell you a little bit about themselves so that they, when people stand up and read really long bios, it becomes dry when, in fact, I know these two people do incredible work and I want them to bring their lives and their work in vibrant color rather than having me read a boring bio. So first I'm going to introduce my colleague, Tanya Chafee, who does a lot of work with adolescents. And she's going to talk about, it's going to be an overview on LGBT health disparities. And as she just told me, it's a little bit dry, so I'm going to say that for you, because she wants to just kind of some foundational facts. And what I'm going to ask you to do is, if you have questions, to jot them down, and then we're going to make sure that we have time at the end for you to ask questions. If you don't understand something, by all means, please raise your hand and ask a clarifying question. But we'll save a little time at the end for discussion. Sound good?
Well, good evening, and thank you very much for coming. So, as Beth mentioned, my history at UCSF goes actually in utero. My mom delivered here at UCSF. I'm actually a UCSF baby. So I'm a native of San Francisco. But I did come, I didn't do education as much until I came out here for residency in pediatrics. So I'm not going to give you my resume. But I've been back in San Francisco since the early 90s, which was an interesting time because that's kind of peak of sort of the AIDS epidemic. And I did personally go to, unfortunately, quite too many funerals. I'll kind of hint on that when we talk about disparities. So I am a pediatrician, and I actually physically work with Beth over at the General. I'm still calling it the General. I'm sorry, I can't wrap my name around the new thing yet. It's the General. And actually, I came back here, just a little background, and that's what made me kind of fall in love with San Francisco again. Was when they had Ward 5A. Does anybody here know about the General and Ward 5A? Some people do. Okay. And that was fortunately, a whole ward that was dedicated to people who were dealing with sort of end-stage AIDS and all the complications of that. The fortunate thing is that ward actually doesn't exist anymore, which is a good thing. And it's mostly an outpatient clinic. But it sort of, this is what I think was ground zero for really kind of looking at LGBT health. And I actually recommend a video that I saw recently called When We Were Here. Has anybody heard of this movie? It's a great documentary because I think it is done in San Francisco and it archives some things. But there's a generational thing that's happened since that kind of epidemic. And my friends call it the plague because it really was a plague. And I think a lot of people kind of have PTSD. Even talking about it, but the movie kind of documents that. So I am a pediatrician, but I specialize in adolescent health. So I have a little bit more of that lens, and I can definitely speak to that. As someone who's getting older myself, I can speak to a little bit of the other life course stages. I put the LGBT term, and I'll never forget one day I had this. I think it was like a resume or something. I gave it to one of my staff people at one of my 8 million training years, and they said, "What does LGBT mean?" And I guess I just assumed, you know, being in San Francisco, everybody knows what LGBT means. And as an adolescent provider, you can put that alphabet soup about another 20 letters because it's LGBTQIA, and there's a new P, which I'll mention, a P that's added to that. But I'm just going to briefly go over this just so we're all on the same page. And there's different ways that people define this. But lesbian, gay are people who are attracted to and have or desire to have intimate relationships with individuals of the same gender. Bisexual, people attracted to and who have or desire to have intimate relationships with individuals of both genders. And transgender, I'm going to talk much more about all of these. People identify or express their gender as the opposite of their biological birth. Okay, these are kind of the generic definitions. Now, orientation, and there's been a lot of research looking at this. It's really pretty much grounded in science that it's not a choice, and it's not a lifestyle. It's really not only an identity, it can be described as behaviors, but it's sort of, a person comes into themselves of identifying this. But that's in the context of all these social norms, which I think challenge it. And it is a spectrum, and I know this very personally dealing with adolescents because they're in the midst of that. Most people kind of define their sexual orientation, not their gender orientation, around the time of when puberty happens. Now, there is more and more evidence that that may be happening earlier. And I think as we learn more and more about brain development and how that formulates, I'll give you an example. I'm at the stage where a lot of young people are starting to engage in sexual behaviors. And I think adolescence is just like early childhood when you learn to walk, you learn to talk. You're making these what we call milestones. You know, we always talk about when did the kids start to walk? When did your baby start to say their first word? Adolescence has similar milestones. And I know this because one of my favorite questions around sexual development is when they have their first crush. We know now the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that you actually have these huge emotion, that's emotional core. Those neurons really just go crazy during adolescence. They're connecting all over, including the emotional part. And most people develop their first crush in early adolescence. And the interesting thing is, who is that crush with? That's the big black box. We know a little bit about these emotions and how they're connected to the brain and the wiring. It's that emotional thing. And so that may be a crush, but there's a higher intellectual thinking of who am I as a human being. I think that's the thing that's really kind of this broad spectrum. And it's of course not solidified in adolescence. So sexual identity formation is really influenced by a lot of other things, not just sort of the biology and where they are in their developmental process, but cultural, social, and other biological factors. And we kind of talk about this as coming out, but it's not just the individual. It's who they come out to, how they come out. And I think actually when a person comes out, there's sort of the context of their community and their family. I'm going to let Caitlin talk much more about that. So gender identity, we use this term transgender as really a broad umbrella term, and it's getting even broader, I know, working with adolescents. The kind of typical terms you'll hear is the M to F or F to M, which is the male to female transgender woman or the female to male transgender man. And again, this may not always fit like conventional norms. I'm getting more and more young people who sort of call themselves gender fluid. And I'll see them one visit, and they identify as a girl, and they want she pronouns, and they may have a male name, and the next visit, it may be different. And they may be in that flux period trying to kind of figure out what their real identity is. And it can make it confusing. We have staff kind of like, okay, where are we today? But it is kind of, and it gets to this transition process, which isn't always just completely dynamic. I know you're going to learn a lot more sort of about the whole scope of transgender and transgender surgery, but just to give you that sense. Cisgender would be defined as people who are identifying as the gender that their biology is. Getting to the transgender, and this is a fluid thing, because it does get into not just their identity, but kind of legal aspects. Do they change their name? From the healthcare perspective, you may actually have to like not only change their name, but change their medical record number, merge their new identity with their old identity in their health home. They may go through sort of just the hormone part of it, or they may actually go through full surgery. And that's a very individual type of situation. From the healthcare provider perspective, it's kind of meeting them where they're at. And again, I'm kind of at this place where sometimes there's more dynamics of what that is. And you're going to get a lot more of that in some of the other sessions. But it's thinking about that because it's not just who they are in front of you or the person you meet, but there's a lot of other layers that go into that to kind of help them if they go through this transition. And I think this is where it gets really confusing. And I think we're learning much more. I mean, I think the idea of gender orientation is becoming much more well recognized as a process. I mean, Caitlyn Jenner, of course, put it in the spotlight, as well as some other kind of, you know, Hollywood people. But this does get confusing because I said sexual orientation is fluid, but gender orientation is also fluid. So you can have these things kind of change. And we're learning much more about this. But and the other confusing thing is behavior doesn't always correlate with identity. And that we've known that for quite a while. People use these labels and we want these labels. It gets very hard for the data people. The people want to measure all this. and I'll give you an example. I'm going to talk about it later. In addition to the NIH deciding that we're going to actually study sexual orientation and gender identity as a core of health disparities, which I'm going to get into. It's difficult because, particularly with adolescents, it's a fluid thing. So one year they may identify this on a survey, and the next year they may be something else, if that makes sense. This last year in 2015, there's a national survey of adolescents. It's been going on for about 25, 30 years called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. It's given out to high school students across the country, middle school and high school. And now I'm going to show you some information from San Francisco Unified School District because all the kids there are surveyed. And this is the first year that they've incorporated sexual orientation questions in it. Now, certain places in the country have added those questions in, but again, this is the first time the whole country has been surveyed on this, and there's some pretty profound pieces of information that came from this first ever national survey. But what we do know is that young people sometimes don't always identify with these LGBT. Youth kind of have embraced the term queer, so they may call themselves, I'm a queer, or I'm, you know, I guess, as I mentioned, gender fluid. I have to tell a story. And this was kind of like where I learned a lot of this. I didn't learn any of this in medical school. I learned very little of it in residency, which is, you know, after medical school. I actually didn't have any lectures at all on LGBT health. It's definitely a new area that I've helped incorporate in here in the School of Medicine and a little bit in the School of Nursing. But I use a lot of the education that I have from my own cases, so I want to share one. And this was recently. September in my world is extremely busy. It's sports physical and school physical time. It's just like everybody wants to overbook. I don't know. Does anybody here have kids in high school? Okay. It's just the clinics are packed up. I have this 12-year-old, cute little young man, and he came in, and my medical assistant said, I'm not sure if he's a he or a she. And he was asking, we're like, okay, kind of trying to figure it out. He did identify as a he. And I said, I said, had you started having a crush? He said, yeah, I actually have a boyfriend. I said, oh, you have a boyfriend. I go, so are you identifying? I go, so how do you identify? He says, well, I identify as pansexual. He's 12 years old. I was like, you know what pansexual means? He goes, yeah, I haven't figured it out. So pansexual is sort of the everything. Not really identified with a gender yet. Not really identified with who they're attracted to yet. Again, he was 12, but it was just sort of interesting. So I do want to add that as one of the things that young people do identify as. Men who have sex with men, you know, they may identify as heterosexual, even though they're having sex with men. And there's other labels that other cultures use. I don't know if anybody's heard of the two-spirit. That's kind of a term that's used with Native Americans. So what I'm going to do now is kind of go through the kind of life courses, and I'm going to kind of go through sort of the health disparities that we know of to sort of demonstrate some things. And I want to hark to what Beth mentioned. There's really, it's starting to learn more now that we have national data sets that are actually examining some of this, but we really don't have good information like we do with race, ethnicity, and even gender. So take a lot of this, and I can tell you where some of the information come, and I listed some of the resources at the end. But I want to also, before I get into that, talk about how health disparities start. When we talk about disparities at all, we look at things like race, ethnicity, and gender. But I think the important thing is there's nothing inherent about being an LGBT person that puts you at risk. It's not biologic. What really is, it's that social stigma around that and the lack of social support, acceptance that leads to isolation that really contributes to those risk factors. And I think that's the important thing. So it's kind of more, much more, it is all environmental. And it's also those things, the social stigma, the lack of support and acceptance, that is displayed as homophobia and transphobia. And that can be internal homophobia and transphobia, or can be the perception of the people around an individual. So how does that play out? Well, an LGBT person may internalize their own societal, they may be experiencing it or understand it. And with young people, I see this all the time, because I'll have a young person who comes out to me in my clinic, but they're not out to anybody yet. And I do feel that they're very vulnerable. And there's a lot of reasons why they may not come out. And there's, you know, cultural things, religious things, family things, school things, and so forth. And that's when you see these health disparities, you kind of have to take that into context. So what does that do? It makes you feel like you're less than, have less self-worth, which can contribute to taking risks, numbing yourself up, using drugs. You feel like there's something wrong with you, so you're ashamed of who you are. Again, when you think about adolescents, and this is when they're starting to develop their identity and they realize they're not like everybody else, so they start to take more risks and they do things. They may have more unprotected sex. They may, you know, do things that put them in harm's way. And the worst thing here is suicidality, and I'll actually show you some of these. So I just want to put this into context of how these health disparities are created. So as I mentioned, children and adolescents are the ones that are starting to develop who they are. I often get talked to talk on transgender health, but I always say this is actually happening way before they see me in my clinic, because gender issues do start much earlier. The human brain kind of knows at 2 or 3 years of age what gender they are. They can see it, and they may have labels for it. And by 3 or 4, it can be stable. There may be a component that it's not. What we're learning now is that there may be a component of young kids who may be kind of gender fluid, and by the time they get to adolescence, they may not be like wanting to shift their gender. It may actually be more of an orientation type thing. This is very new, and people are starting to look at this, particularly as we're looking at gender variant kids. By the time you're kind of school age, they may identify as the opposite of their biological gender. And they might do this as in both with dress and behavior. This was a study actually by a group here in the Bay Area, Gender Spectrum, and I have the resource at the end of the slides. But this is looking at when kids kind of were able to sort of let you know that they were not the age that their biological, I'm sorry, the gender of what their biological gender was. It was opposite of that. So as you can see, it happens much earlier, in sort of 3 and 4 years of age. That's not to say that it doesn't happen later on either, but this is typically when it does happen. So by adolescence, and I know Caitlin's going to speak a little bit to this, we used to think that orientation happened kind of almost in early adulthood. But when we really, and that was sort of like retrospective, when we do it more real time, we're seeing it's younger and younger. And I think it's important to note, when I put the, you know, 9 for males and 10 for females, that's when puberty starts. And it's not just the hormones and the actual phenotype or your body changing. There's so much going on in the brain. Remember the amygdala that I told you about, where you sort of get this first crush. But when a person actually comes out, may come out in later adolescence. And again, I think that gets to sort of the societal norms. This is, as I mentioned, is a question that's the dynamics of what we see now has changed as we start to get better and better information on it. But again, it's not typically asked. And if you think about it, this can be, a kid may not want to put what they are in a survey because they're afraid of what the information means. So a lot of people sort of feel what we are getting may be an underrepresentation, but I'll show you what we know. So as I mentioned, the YRBS survey, and this is looking at nationally. Again, these are kids attending school. So one of the things we know about LGBT youth is a lot of them run away or not in school. So they're not being counted on a lot of this. Again, this is probably an underrepresentation, but 2% of high school students identify as gay or lesbian, 6% bisexual, and 3.2% were unsure. So I'm going to quickly go through some of this, but as you can imagine, there's a whole session next week on violence and victimization, and that's a huge, huge issue. The other interesting thing is sort of reproductive health is another one. You see higher rates of sexually transmitted infections in both women and men who may be gay identified. And you actually see higher rates of pregnancy. And when I first started learning this myself, it was hard for me to believe this. I can tell you, as a clinician, this rings true. Definitely higher mental health and suicide, and have some information on that. And eating disorders. We know we have young men who come in with eating disorders. That's kind of on our radar. Is there an orientation issue going on? And obesity in females. And what you'll see again is these kind of can stay on through adulthood and in your elder years. So this was the YRBS survey that gets into some of the health disparities, and I think these are some of the profound ones. So about a 3 times higher rate of LGB. They did not ask about trans youth on this. They're looking at that. They're testing out the questions to see if it's actually measuring, people who may be gender variant. But 3 times higher rates of having attempted suicides. This was just the last year's data. Having attempted suicide versus hetero, and 5 times had attempted, excuse me, that's incorrect, were feeling like they wanted to have suicide was 3 times. 5 times was had attempted suicide. 2.5 times had not gone to school because they felt unsafe. And there's a bunch of other looking at sexual victimization, but this is just one of them, that they were 3 times more likely to have been forced to have sex versus heterosexual peers. This is an actual breakout from San Francisco Unified School District. And these are middle school students who tried to kill themselves. And as you look at the last end one, that is the LGBT students. And the H, the blue one, is heterosexual identified. So you see the huge, huge, huge disparate two bars. The presenter that I met with from the San Francisco Unified School District said, unfortunately, they've been measuring this sexual orientation in San Francisco Unified School District for 10 years. This hasn't changed very much at all. The rates, the difference between heterosexual and LGBT and identified. This is like looking at percentage of high school students. The previous one was middle school. Now, I don't want to sound depressing about all this, because I think there's a lot of positive things about young people. And as we're learning, they're very resilient. So we always look at risk factors that contribute to health disparities, but they are very very resilient. And many, many more LGBTQ youth. I've had young people now who are engaged to be married at the age of 22. I couldn't imagine that 10 years ago. So it's very kind of rewarding. They're resilient to some of the things that happen, and one of the nice things about high schools is that's been changing quite a bit, sort of implementation of more and more gay-straight alliances. And that young people, I think, today, with more and more role models out there, feel like they have more hope and purpose. So let me go into adulthoods, which I'm going to talk about partnerships and families. And again, as we don't have good information on this because it's not recorded, but for those nationally, and this is for identifying as either homosexual or bisexual, about you get 2-4% for men and lower for women, about 1-4%. Now, a lot of the surveys may ask about same-sex behaviors, and that may not correlate to identity. Men, 6-9% have sex with men, and women, 4-11% have sex with women. And the transgender, it's all over the map. And again, this may be a significant underrepresentation, but you get as low as 0.1 to as high as 0.5% nationally. As I mentioned from the adolescence, these health disparities do seem to go on into adulthood. You do see higher drug and alcohol use and addiction compared to heterosexual, much higher rates of cigarette smoking in both gay men and gay women, as well as trans individuals. And then higher rates of sexually transmitted infections, particularly in gay men and trans women, as well as the viral hepatitis and HIV. higher rates of obesity, as you heard, with adolescents in women, and eating disorders in men. Cancers, and this is a big issue that is a little bit related to HIV, but anorectal cancers and HIV cancers in bisexual men and men. Breast cancers and other reproductive health organ cancers in women, as well as trans women. I should say trans men. And then mental health, depression, anxiety, and suicidality, which you see kind of happening in adolescence and going into adulthood. And significantly higher rates. I didn't show you the exact, but the rates in the high school, the first YRBS study did show that there were significantly higher rates of intimate partner violence in adolescence, which does translate into adulthood. And you're going to hear much more about that next week. So one of the things that contributes to that is how LGBT people access healthcare. Because as you saw, the rates of cancer and things that are easily screenable, there's some barriers. And one of the things that I know we've been trying to do within our own training curricula is to really let people understand that. And the hardest thing about that is, if you think about schools, is people come from their own cultures and belief systems when they come to a university to be trained. And I know this because we have a class that's taught in the medical school for second-year medical students called Life Cycle, and they go from preconception to death, and they learn sort of the stages of life. And we do, it was the first course ever that the School of Medicine had, was a 3-hour lecture on LGBT health. And it was actually, I was one of the small group leaders, so we have 14 students in the class, and it was probably one of the most challenging courses to teach for me, because you have a lot of people from a lot of values and belief systems. And we've had, you know, to really kind of work with that. So if you can think of that, and then you're trying to teach that, like I'm teaching you guys today, and some of these slides are even from the course that I taught to kind of help students really understand, this is how this happens and why people don't seek services. So you see this. Women who have same-sex relations report that they don't see a provider in the last year. They don't get the screening things that they need. So this is why you see these health disparities. You see higher rates of cervical cancer because they haven't had a pap test. There's the assumption that because you're having sex with women, you're not at risk for having cervical cancer. They're not likely to have a usual source of care. It's just sort of urgent care. And they may have many other unmet medical needs. What's interesting, too, is that we're finding gay men who are in relationships are less likely to gain in high-risk sexual behavior, and we're starting to see that kind of trend down across the country as well as in San Francisco. I'm not going to go a whole lot into this, but this is, again, just to give you an overview, which is pretty profound. 39% of men in same-sex relationships reported being in a physical, psychological, or sexual abusive relationship with an intimate partner. Women in same-sex relationships, depending on the survey, do also have similar or higher or lower rates of IPV versus heterosexual women. And there's another layer that's added to this, because they can use outing a person if a person's not out in that relationship as a way to threaten them. And that can be a sense of coercion. You know, they may be living kind of secret lives because of circumstances that may be familial or job related or whatever, and they're not out to the world, but they're out in this relationship, but that may be used against them. And persuading a partner to leave the relationship if they do something, which you see with heterosexual relationships. And the assumption that women can't be violent or that men are always violent can be some other things that kind of are different with same-sex relationships. This is a huge area that we're starting to learn much more about. And I think trans individuals probably suffer the highest rates of discrimination. And we know that. I used to be a board member of the LGBT Center, and they were one of the first organizations in the whole city to have a transgender employment fair to help employers hire trans. Trans people have about 70% unemployment in San Francisco. It's pretty profound. And a lot of people come to the city because they think it's kind of the, you know, gay Mecca and that they'll get services, but unfortunately they find that there aren't anything available to them. So this was a national survey, and they had over 6,000 transgender respondents. So of this, of the survey, 65% lost a job due to bias, 51% reported being harassed and bullied in school, 61% physical abuse, 64% sexual assault, and didn't seek preventative care. In the last, 33 had not sought any kind of health care that they needed. LGBT families is interesting because we're seeing it's very, very kind of diverse and kind of that, you know, rainbow of families. You may have couples who don't have children, couples who have children or stepchildren from previous relationships. They may be single parents who were gay identified or trans identified. They may have multiple, and I'll talk a little bit more about older adults, but sometimes LGBT people have to go to their family of choice because their biological family has rejected them, but they've sort of figured out their own family and their own community, and they may raise children together. And they may have friends who become the durable power of attorney that makes decisions about the child. So one thing to note with the kind of baby boom that we're having, there was a LGBT baby boom report, which is interesting. Over a quarter of LGBT, this is, didn't include transgender, were raising children. One in three women had given birth. One in six men had adopted or were fathering a child. 50% of gay men and 40% of women wanted to have children. So you're seeing this kind of baby boom happening right now. And it was interesting. They did a little race ethnicity. They found Hispanic couples were raising children 2 to 3 times higher than their white same-sex partners. Transgender relationships, there's very limited information, but you may have one or both partners that are transgender, and you may have one person who's identified, who is transgender and may not have that transitions during the relationship, and they may not have an orientation yet, or they may be identified as their previous orientation with their previous gender. So it gets very dynamic. You may have one transgender person who comes out and the other person then questions their orientation. You can see that dynamic playing out. And sometimes it can actually end up in divorce, but it can be very dynamic, especially during that transition period. I actually have two colleagues who've transitioned in adulthood, and both were M to Fs, and one did very, is still, they're doing very well, and one unfortunately did end up in divorce. One thing we don't think about is the LGBT elders. Thank you. And just to kind of give you background, because I think of sort of the history of sort of non-accepting sort of society in the United States, many more older people may not be out to the greater community. And so many of them may be estranged from their families and, as I mentioned, have developed their own sense of community and their own kind of chosen family. And many older LGBT adults may kind of be alone. And we see this in some of the surveys that we've seen. They also may feel very at risk of being outed when they're sick. So they may not come out to providers. As I mentioned from the baby boom report, there's more and more people who are coming out at older ages, but there's fewer that are likely to be partnered compared to heterosexual. So 20% versus 50%. More likely to live alone, 65 to 70%. So if you think if you're older, you're not going to have kids that are going to help you in your older years, like heterosexual couples. And so there's a lot of anxiety around that. Who's going to take care of me? How am I going to get help compared to the heterosexual sort of idea that your children are going to help you? We don't have anything really on transgender adults. So this kind of does lead to some discrimination. As you see, the health disparities can contribute later on. But what you also see is more and more sort of this depression and isolation. And actually, 2/3 of elder adults have reported feeling victimized compared to their heterosexual peers. They're less likely to get, as you saw with adults, the normal routine screening, such as breast cancer. For trans individuals, it's even higher. And we're learning more about this because you do need to know what has happened. Has a person had their uterus removed and their cervix removed if they're F to M? Because then you wouldn't need to do a pap smear, but you would if it was. And so healthcare providers are not always trained in how to do this and working with trans people. And one interesting thing is about 12% of trans women and 1% of trans men transition after the age of 55. As I mentioned with the Baby Boomer report, this is just to give you a sense of how LGBT elders feel about how they're treated in the, and this just comes from experience through their lifetime. 50% had no confidence they'd be treated with dignity or respect by the medical people they were seeking care from. 12% of lesbians had no confidence they would receive unbiased treatment. And this discrimination kind of became greater at the older that they got. Long-term care is another one. I'm just going to quickly go through this. And there's a citation I have that can give you more of this information. But if a person is in long-term care and their partner's there, the idea that their partner can't room with them or be with them or make the decisions about their care, this is changing with marriage laws, obviously, but some gay couples may not have gone down the marriage path, so there still may be some health decision discrimination. And that the staff and everybody won't really respect their gender for transgender, that their gender identity of transgender patients. I do also want to not speak on this negative, depressing kind of report, because there are some great things to know that LGBT people that have been surveyed, you do see a greater kind of sense that they want to be healthy, taking on more wellness activities. They feel when they're very connected with their community, again, that becomes their sort of other family. That those that are in relationships, that those are the relationships that kind of give them that resilience, and that 83% have people who feel like that they're with someone that they really enjoy being with. And it might not be a long-term relationship, but it may be sort of a companion. So this is, and I'm sorry if you can't read the yellow too well, it doesn't come up on the slides, but this is just to give you some resources. A lot of this came from the first ever Institute of Medicine report that actually Caitlin was one of the authors of, the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, which does a lot of training across the country. It's a medical organization of providers that really have annual conferences every year and present a lot of the information. The Fenway Institute does a lot of online training, and they do some of these slides actually come from that, and they're open access to anybody. It's in Boston. I mentioned the Family Acceptance Project, which you'll hear much more about from Caitlin. And then the kind of local things are the Gender Spectrum, which does a lot of working with families of trans young people as well as trans kids themselves, and coordinates the services if they do want to go through transition. And the Model Outreach Program, this is working with elder adults and sort of looking at the baby boomer population. So we'll take questions at the end, and I will now have Caitlin come up. Thank you.
Hi, good evening, everybody. Are you excited? How many of you are members of the public who are with us tonight? Excellent, fantastic. And how many of you are health or mental health providers? How many of you work with LGBT young people? Great, well, we're all very excited to have you here. I'm always excited to be back. My name is Caitlin Ryan. I'm a clinical social worker and a researcher and a policy analyst. And I have actually worked on LGBT health over the course of my career for now 41 years. The Family Acceptance Project grew out of this work. I started working in the organizing the early LGBT health movement, did the first national study of lesbian health to characterize and define lesbian health needs, worked in the early AIDS epidemic, actually, was an organizer of the first AIDS organization in the South at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, began to develop early clinical care guidelines for what we called back then lesbian and gay adolescents. And all of that led to my identifying a profound and right in front of our face gap for LGBT young people, which was families. Historically, over the decades, families have been missing from not only being a resource and a source of support, but also being involved and engaged in the lives of their LGBT children. I'll tell you a little bit about this. I want to acknowledge Dr. Tanya Chafee, who's been from the very beginning at the front end of our very large participatory process of doing research, intervention work, developing the first family-based model of wellness prevention and care. So not only is she a dedicated clinician and involved with all kinds of activities across the board locally, statewide, and nationally, but she's taken the time to invest her energy and skills into our work, and I really appreciate that. I'm right down the street at San Francisco State University. Actually, people usually think that I'm at USF, but I'm not. In fact, many, many people have published press releases saying that I'm at USF, and finally I got to speak over there one day, and they said, well, we're very happy to have you. I don't have a lot of time, so because I want to do a number of things. So I'm going to keep an eye on my watch, and I'm going to skip through some of these. I want to set the stage for contemporary LGBT children and adolescents. Dr. Chafee talked about that word dynamic, which is so important, because these are identities that are really emerging, evolving, developing through the context of time, and they've been doing that through the context of history. And they really started in times in history where no one could be out, and certainly not young people, even though if you go back to the early studies in the 1970s, you're going to see many adults who knew who they were at early ages, but it just wasn't possible for them to be who they were at that early age. I'll only be able to talk about a few of our research findings, but I'll do that. I'll talk about some of the really important ones. We've now done 10 studies from our work in a range of areas. We've developed the first family model of wellness prevention and care for LGBT children and adolescents. I'll tell you a little bit about that, and hopefully we'll have time to fit in one of our short family intervention and education videos. What we've done in our work with the Family Acceptance Project is really to shift the frame. I know it may seem crazy, but when we started this work, families were not only invisible, they were not involved. And the main way that LGBT young people were served, going back to the late 1970s, was through peer support. So providers across disciplines, even in my discipline of social work where we talked about everything, didn't ask an adolescent about their family because the assumption was that all families were rejecting, they were incapable of growth and change, and that the most important thing they could do was to get them peer support to help them really figure out how to integrate their identity in the context of the LGBT community. So in our work, we've shown with our research that, in fact, family reactions have a compelling relationship between what happens during adolescence and that young adult. I believe that if we did our same study over every cohort after the 20s, we'd find exactly the same thing, except that few people would be alive because of the stress and stigma that Dr. Chafee talked about. One of the exciting things for us is that now we have worked with families from all different kinds of ethnic groups and religious backgrounds and immigrant families and families from all different kinds of social worlds. And we found that our work makes sense for them. And in fact, families who are religiously and socially conservative can understand what we're saying, and our work helps them balance deeply held beliefs with an underlying bond with that child. So in fact, our research findings and family support approach give them a reason to modify rejecting behaviors that our research shows relate to a significant increase in risk for that LGBT young people person. These are some of the serious health and really social risks that LGBT young people experience. We've had a lot of school-based documentation over the years, going back to the early 90s in Massachusetts, on the youth risk behavior as more and more states began to add a question about sexual orientation and sexual behavior. And then here, much more recently in San Francisco, on one of our school-based studies, started to add a question on transgender identity. So in each one of these arenas, LGBT young people are not only overrepresented, but significantly so. And one of these serious health concerns that contributes to so much of our health disparities, homelessness, the media have recently begun to identify and report an estimate that about 40% of homeless young people are LGBT, and there recently has been a great awareness that we should do something about it. I think what people don't realize is that statistic came from the 1980s. That estimate has been around since the 1980s. And if I were to go back and parse each one of these disparities, you'd see them overrepresented in adults in terms of suicide attempts going back into the first studies that were ever done on non-clinical or non-prison samples of homosexual adults. The really exciting and I think incredibly mobilizing issue for us is that we found that family intervention, family engagement, family support can not only help prevent but can address and reduce the severity of these serious health concerns. And that I think is very, very important, because any of you who work with young people, the fact that we are not serving their families everywhere in every kind of setting across the board, this is a serious concern. So there's a really good reason why young people are coming out increasingly at younger ages. If you went back to the 70s, the average age of self-identifying as gay, that was the word that was typically used, was probably 19, 20, 21, 22. If you came more recently into the 90s, those ages would have dropped to between 14 and 16 on average. And coming forward in time, it's dropped much younger. And people say, well, why is this? You know, what's happening? What's in the water? Well, we're all carrying it on our person somewhere. It's connection to an information arena, an incredible display, where regardless of where we are, that taps us into identities and imagery and experiences that we never had access to before. And young people across the board, across all cultural worlds, languages, experiences, are seeing this. They're seeing themselves represented. They didn't have language for it before, but they do now. This has irrevocably changed everything, and it means that the way that we were serving young people before isn't going to cut it when young people are coming out and being identified at such young ages. So if we think about some of the information that Dr. Chafee talked about, these are really average ages. There's an average awareness of gender in a young child at about age 3, where they have a sense of who they are by the colors they want to choose, or the clothes they want to wear, or the toys they want to play with, or their play behavior. They're expressing that gender regardless of whether they are in fact transgender or gender diverse or fit into, you know, those small boxes of gender in our culture. They're expressing that at really early ages. And on average, we've known for research that goes back into the early 90s that children have their first crush at around age 10, whether they're gay or straight. If you put this together with an average age of coming out, self-identifying as lesbian, gay, or bisexual as 13 in our research, and increasingly families coming to us from all over the U.S., my daughter is 7, she's 8, she's gay, she said, Mom, where are the other kids? You know, where can we find other families? Where can we go for play dates? Well, we don't have that because we haven't organized our world around children who are LGBT. And yet, if we really think about it, this is no longer a phenomena of adulthood. This is what's called normative development when the information barriers are removed. So we're really seeing that this is an issue of childhood, and our schools, our agencies, all of all kinds, even LGBT services, health and mental health care, congregations, have not really been prepared to serve, address, guide, and provide accurate information about sexual orientation to families with LGBT children and adolescents. And that I think, is a challenge for all of us, regardless of the role that we play in our community. So 15 years ago, this coming year, with my colleague Rafael Diaz and a group of intrepid community members and providers here in the Bay Area, we started the Family Acceptance Project that would not only provide the first comprehensive research on LGBT young people and their families, but also professional education and training, family-oriented model of prevention and care and inform public policy. And that's what we've been doing ever since. And our aim was that our unit of support and intervention was the whole family. So to strengthen that family, to prevent young people from ending up out of home, and if they did, to help them reconnect with their families, to introduce a model across disciplines and systems of care that would support young people who are LGBT and whatever definitions or language they use to describe themselves in the context of their families, cultures, and faith traditions. And in fact, to go upstream to begin to bring this information across the board to families with young children. So believe it or not, in 2002, it was the first time someone had studied the whole family of an LGBT young person. Before that, there were a couple of studies with a survey question, check the box kind of question. But we went in depth all across California into urban, rural, suburban, farm worker communities, coastal villages, bilingually, biculturally, in English and Spanish. Almost all of the interviews that we did were in people's homes, all across the state, up to the bottom and down to the top, and all across into the Central Valley. And we spent 2 to 4 hours each with each individual family member, focused around individually that LGBT young person, looking at early childhood development, the emergence of gender identity and their LGBT identity, cultural and religious experiences, sources of support, school experiences, peer and victimization, hopes and dreams for the future. And in those thousands of pages of transcripts, we identified over 100 specific ways that key family members, parents, caregivers, guardians, foster parents, whoever the primary caregivers were, responded to that LGBT child. Those were behaviors like trying to change or prevent them from having an LGBT identity, making them pray or attend religious services to alter or prevent who they are, not letting them have an LGBT friend, versus finding a positive role model to give them a sense of the future, or supporting their emergence into LGBT programming and services, helping them find resources, giving them positive things to read about themselves. And we measured all of those accepting and rejecting behaviors in a survey of LGBT young adults. And then we spent a lot of time taking the findings back to families all over the community. So we did this work in English, Spanish, and Chinese. We did it from families from all different kinds of backgrounds with LGBT young people and their providers. And we had them teach us how to unpack our findings, how to talk about them, how to message them, how to frame them, what kinds of materials family wanted to learn to support their child, what they needed to help educate their own families, their community leaders, their religious leaders, what would really help them see themselves in a world that typically had excluded diversity. And that was the basis of our family intervention model. So in essence, we took all of those behaviors and we wanted to look at how parents, families, caregivers expressed them and how those behaviors related to that LGBT young person's health and mental health. We found, not surprisingly, that most families were actually ambivalent. That was really good news. Most people believed that all families were rejecting when we started this, but we expected that most would in fact be ambivalent. We found that about a third were rejecting, but the really good news was that so many of them could become accepting and supportive if someone knew how to provide guidance and information in a way that was culturally relevant for them. About 1 in 5 were accepting, and a small proportion of them actually celebrated who that LGBT child was from the very beginning, which was really exciting. These are some of the common family rejecting behaviors that we measured. Denial, it's a phase, they'll grow out of it, it's not real. Blaming young people when others mistreated them because of who they were. Not letting them talk, maintaining silence in the family. And we measured all of these to show how they affected those health risks. These are some of the more than 50 supportive and accepting family reactions, supporting your child's gender expression, believing that they can have a good life and a happy future. And we measured all of these to show how they were protective and promoted well-being. So we connected what happened during adolescence with their risk and well-being as young adults. And this is some of what we found. These are young people who were thinking of taking their lives in the past 6 months from families that were not at all accepting, a little, somewhat, very, or extremely. And you can see that in those not at all accepting families, almost 60% were thinking of taking their lives. But this is what happens with just a little bit of acceptance. It really drops significantly, which signals that it doesn't have to be all or nothing, that a little bit of change can really open the door to greater connectedness and greater hope. And this is certainly very hopeful for educators and others, providers who work with young people and their families. If you go all the way over to extremely accepting, you can see that that rate is so much lower. So we found that the dose really matters, the dose of rejection or acceptance. With a lot of rejection, we saw lots of illegal drug use and other kinds of serious health risks, a more than 3 times greater likelihood of using illegal drugs, and cut in half with moderate levels of family rejection during adolescence. A similar pattern with putting oneself at high risk for HIV, for sexual health risk, more than 3 times greater likely of putting oneself at high risk with lots of rejection during adolescence. Again, cut in half with moderate levels of rejection. Suicide is so scary for parents. They hear a lot about this, and yet we could show this relationship between lots of rejection during adolescence with a more than 8 times greater likelihood of attempted suicide, and cut significantly with moderate levels of family rejection. We also show that when parents tried to change their children's gender, internal sense of gender, and pressure them to fit into the parents' perceptions of gender, which often were much narrower and much more constricted, we saw very high levels of clinical depression, about a 4 times greater likelihood of attempted suicide and using illegal drugs, and about twice as likely to put oneself at risk for HIV. We found that when young people were accepted by their families, they were so much more likely to see, believe, perceive that they could have a good life, a happy future. And this affects so many things: self-care, health promotion, who our social support system is, choices and decisions that we make, vocational planning, etc. We found that family acceptance helped protect against suicidal behavior, depression, substance abuse, and that it actually promoted overall self-esteem, general health, and well-being, which is so important when we think about what are the things that we can do to promote wellness and protect against these serious health disparities. So in essence, for the first time with research, we had showed empirically that family rejection is actually linked with serious health and mental health concerns, and that acceptance is both protective against risk and helps promote well-being for LGBT young people. Well, it's not enough to do a lot of research papers. You have to apply them. So that's what we did. We developed a family intervention model here in the Bay Area. Lots of different kinds of strategic approaches, including research-based intervention and assessment tools and educational materials to help providers and families across the board decrease those rejecting behaviors and increase supportive behaviors to change outcomes for that LGBT young person. These are some of the family education booklets that we've developed. They are the first best practice resources for suicide prevention for LGBT young people. We've started developing a family video series that is really designed to fill a critical gap, one to show ethnically and religiously diverse families with LGBT children and how they learn to support that LGBT child. Because, as I mentioned earlier, the majority of families initially were ambivalent. We wanted to find a way to give young people and families hope, to humanize their lives because so many of them have been dehumanized, especially the parents, who rejecting parents were really seen in an adversarial role. And so many providers have had a hard time building an alliance with them to learn to support that LGBT young person. So what does this really mean in practice? Well, it means that there's always hope. And it means that if we, in fact, go upstream to start to educate, guide, provide accurate information, the greatest barrier to supporting an LGBT child in the context of the family is inaccurate information about sexual orientation and gender identity, and actually intergenerational disinformation and misinformation. Most of the place where providers interact with young people who are perhaps providing mental health services or counseling is going to be in that space related to family conflict, where all of a sudden that child's emerging identity comes into conflict with the parents' cultural and social worlds and values and beliefs. We can intervene there and help make a difference. And finally, unfortunately, increasingly, because of that early age of coming out, so many more young people are ending up out of home. As Dr. Chafee pointed out, those disparities, that what we know about the percentages, haven't dropped. They haven't dropped for a really simple reason. We haven't changed the cultural and social climates. And this offers us an opportunity to transform cultures from within by meeting parents, families, caregivers, religious leaders, decision makers where they are, and providing guidance and information in a way that really is culturally relevant for them. But this requires us to shift how we think about families, and that's part of what we do with our materials now. Families are allies for their children, and we have to see them that way, not as adversaries. We have to understand that the motives to engage in those behaviors to prevent their child from being who they are really designed to protect their children. It's a way of caring for them and keeping them connected to the family and their cultural worlds. But of course, we can show empirically in any language, and our work has been translated widely, and it's used with families across cultural worlds, that when you engage in behaviors that are really diminishing and preventing and constricting and obliterating that child's sense of who they really are, that's not a healthful response. That actually is significantly increasing your child's risk. And so we help families understand that they can learn to support that LGBT child, even if they disagree and think that being gay or transgender is wrong. And we've spent a lot of time figuring out how to do this, and we've trained now about 80,000 providers, families, and religious leaders across the U.S. and other countries, and we've been integrating our work in a range of communities. We've paid a high price for writing families off. These terrible health disparities are really a result of not providing the level of support at the basic unit of society, which is families, communities, cultural worlds. One of the outcomes of pulling that child out of their cultural world, in essence, which is what happens typically when a young person is seen as struggling and there's all that conflict in the family and no one really knows what to do, is they lose the innate protective factors from their culture, ethnicity, and family. And families lose critical health information that they need to make appropriate decisions for their child. But it's not enough to have one provider in a community or maybe one supportive congregation or a supportive coach. We really have to integrate this new family-based approach to wellness and care into all of our services, because still now providers don't know how to engage families, they don't know how to talk to them, they're reluctant to bring these issues up, and so much of the work that we do is educating, guiding, and providing information. I brought some flyers and some examples of some of our family education booklets tonight if anybody's interested. All right, so I'll just end it there, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Ask questions. You have two fabulous speakers, and we have a question. Do you want to come up here, Caitlin, and then that way we can
Sure.
Yeah, questions.
This is a new one for me.
Yep. You're starting to see it more and more, just a way to sort of identify those who are not trans. It's the term.
So who would be a cisgender?
I'm cisgender. I consider myself cisgender because I identify with a female gender.
In other words, if you identify with the physical gender that you were born into, most of us are cisgender.
Yeah.
And the term has been around for quite a while, but it hasn't been more widely used until more recently.
Okay, so whatever you were biologically...
If you identify with your biological gender.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
You mentioned some estimates of sources for trans folk between, I think, 0.1 and 0.5%.
Mm-hmm.
What are the sources for those?
Yeah, the question was, what were the sources for the estimates of trans individuals? It's a little biased. There was one, I think it was 100,000 person survey. It wasn't a national survey that came up with the higher end of 0.4. There's other ones that have been sort of estimates based on from the medical world of sort of people coming in and identifying and doing estimates on sort of their general population, which may be underestimates as well. It's a really hard question to ask, again, because of the fluidity. And that's why it's not. I know even here at UCSF, when we were trying to just do a survey of looking at the staff and faculty and students, this was a question that had a lot of debate on how you would ask it, because it's when they ask transgender, is it what they identify M to F, or is it leave it blank? So it becomes a unknown, and then it gets even more difficult when you ask if it's a trans woman or a trans man. We really don't know.
If I could add to that, I recently had to get some statistics, so I talked to one of the top transgender researchers, and they pointed me to a population-based study in Massachusetts, adolescents about ages 13 to 18, and they that percentage of the population was there was 1.7 identified as transgender. I actually believe that we're going to be seeing a higher proportion of people identifying as LGBT, especially in childhood and much younger, because now that the information barriers have been removed, so to speak, and the stigma is being dispelled to some extent, more and more young people are self-identifying. That doesn't mean that the risks are removed. They're still there, but I think it's going to be harder for young people to repress who they are. And that really speaks to those of you who work with children and adolescents.
Did that answer your question?
I think so. I'm curious to know if there are any estimates, especially for folks who are pursuing hormones or top or bottom surgery.
Mm-hmm. No.
Are there any numbers where they indicate sort of how many folks?
It's a great question. It's something that everybody's looking at right now. The first country that really sort of looked at this from a health perspective, Finland?
Netherlands.
Which really looked at, and in children, and looked at, like, because they have a national health system that looks at everybody who coming in the door, which a lot of countries don't have. The idea of UCSF does have a gender clinic for kids and those entering puberty, and I think there's now 5 in the country, and it's modeled off of the one that was started in Boston. And these are extremely new, but they're growing significantly. And I know from some of the people who work at the UCSF Gender Clinic, they're getting referrals from all over the state. But there's more and more of these popping up. They're usually multidisciplinary, and they're sort of headed in the endocrine department, again, but they have sort of wraparound services, kind of working with families, working with the schools, working with social work, and having, you know, psychologists, therapists work with the families, as well as the side part is the hormones and transitioning, which you guys are going to learn much more about in some of the other sessions.
One thing I want to speak to as well is the issue of gender nonconformity, or people of any age who don't fit into those strict cultural boxes of the cultural expectation in that family social world about what that child is supposed to be. That doesn't really mean that that young person or adolescent or whatever age they are is transgender. We've constricted gender for such a long time, and it's now really exploding because there's more space to talk about it, to name it, to label it. So it's a broader band of, it's a spectrum, if you will, And I think very often we just think about the two ends. So I'd speak to the middle as well. Because a child growing up in a world with really rigid cultural expectations about gender can really suffer. And for example, I think in our research, one of the young people that we studied when they were little, they always moved their hands. They still do. And the parents were very disturbed by this because it wasn't what was expected of a boy. So at night, they would tie that little boy's hands to the bed at night. And you can imagine the years of these rejecting behaviors that are cumulative. And that's really how, you know, we can see the range of those rejecting behaviors in young adulthood.
Just a question over there.
I'm here because my daughter is 22 and is a transgender female, and she's going through the transformation right now, and she's trying to get through college and considering surgery. And so I'm trying to get as much information as I can, and it has, you know, and so I'm trying to learn as much as I can and be as supportive as I can. And as you said, there are so many different terms, and her group of friends, she has so many different labels for so many different. So I'm just trying to get as much information as I can and be as supportive as I can, and just be there for her.
And as you've learned from Caitlin's work, I mean, that's what I personally have to address, because I do have young people who tell me they're gay, tell me they may be wanting to transition or not sure about their gender, or sometimes we have to figure it out together. And, you know, the next questions are, who do you have supportive in your life? You know, and usually these interviews are done, you know, along with the child. And it's also, as a pediatrician, we have parents coming and going, there's something up, you know. And the problem is that, again, as Caitlin mentioned, this is happening faster than I think the rest of society is catching up with it. And just intake forms, we had a whole discussion about, when do you start asking these questions around gender in the form when you come in for your visit, the box that you check, you know, when should we change that? Again, these haven't caught up with what's already happening and the kind of normalization that's finally happening with this. So it is a huge jump that I think everybody's having to do and adapt and trying to be as you know, accepting and again, the knowledge. And I can tell you that even with our own schools, the curriculums are not mandatory that you get trained in this, that you have to get trained in this. That's catching up. And I think I'm biased because I think UCSF is really progressive in this, but there's medical schools all across that don't have, you know, lectures on things like which you just got tonight.
Well, I'm also a teacher in elementary school, and we don't address it. And so that's another reason that I'm trying to.
Very aware of that. You saw some of the Unified School District information.
I went through a year of suicidal problems with my daughter. So.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
Is she getting support? There are gender programs in the Bay Area, lots of them, where...
Down in Arizona.
Oh, she's... Arizona, is she in Tucson by any chance? Arizona actually has a large transgender community and lots of resources there.
I think we're through the worst.
Great, excellent. All right.
We're going through the senior year, so
very good.
I think we're good.
Excellent. Glad to hear it.
Was there another question?
Yeah, a lot of the information tonight, understandably, comes from the standpoint of the transgender child, the transgender adult. So maybe the question that this woman's talking about is also about support for the family. And where can they go, and how can they learn and get up to speed? And I think that's Caitlin's project also, talking about the whole family coming in from the adult side, the parent side, the caregiver side.
Yeah, there are lots of resources for that now. In fact, there's one of my colleagues just sent me an information. There's a conference that happens on the West and the East that is for providers, teachers, families, educators. There are two really large conferences, one that happens here with Gender Spectrum, one with Gender Odyssey, where the whole family comes. And those have now been going on for many years, and people come from all over the place. And then one back east in New York as well.
Yes.
Question here. I don't know if I misunderstood your talks, but it seems to me that this gender question exists in a continuum. You start talking about this at 2 or 3. There were some slides talking about this. I am trying to reconcile that with what you said in your presentation of when parents say, this is just a phase.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that what happens with a parent that says that, it's that the kid came out maybe during adolescence. And the parent is thinking, I would have seen this happen before. Well, can you help me reconcile that? It seems to me that a parent that says this is just a phase is a parent that got taken by surprise.
Well, actually, that's not the case. And we did such in-depth interviews, thousands of pages of transcripts with these families. Many of them might say that, but we tracked them back. We tracked them over time. And they would then say, well, I was afraid, or I had an inclination, or I had a feeling, or someone said something to me and I repressed it. So many of these families aren't like taken completely by surprise. There have been little nuggets. Pennies or nuggets that have been dropped for a long period of time. The real issue now is that as a society, we need to be more aware. You talked about the risk for suicide, significant. All of us need to go back to the days when it takes a village. And if we see a young person who's struggling or is in need or starts to become more withdrawn, as we know we see so often, that's a precursor for so many of these issues coming out. We need to step up, take them aside, say, hey, you seem down in the mouth. What's going on? What can I do to help? You seem really quiet these days. Or bring it to the attention of the family or other key people who can get that young person to a pediatrician, a provider, a counselor, et cetera. We all need to provide the support because this really is not an insulated issue. It's a cultural issue. It's a social issue. And the biggest antidote, I think, to the alienation and stigma of these children is social support.
All out of time.
Yes. I want to thank our speakers again for being with us. So.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.